Владимир Путин подписал указ о назначении выборов в
Государственную Госдуму пройдут 18 сентября. Соответствующий указ подписан...
Выборы без выбора. Мировые медиа рассуждают...
225 человек изберут по партийным спискам. Еще столько
же... Агитация завершится в ночь на 17 сентября.
Another political season gets underway in Russia. Владимир Путин kicked off Russia's parliamentary election campaign this week, setting a date for the vote and bidding the outgoing State Duma farewell. Like all Russian elections under Putin, of course, the outcome is not in doubt. But the September 18th election and the campaign leading up to it is important nonetheless as a legitimation ritual for the regime. And as Putin learned the hard way 5 years ago, such rituals can go horribly wrong. Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFURL. Joining me on the Skype line from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, is Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies and host of the SRB podcast. Welcome back, Sean.
Thanks for having me.
And also joining us via Skype from Berlin, making his first but hopefully not last appearance on the podcast, is Maxim Trudolubov, a senior fellow at the Kennan Institute in Washington and editor-at-large of the Russian business daily Vedomosti. Welcome, Max. I've wanted to have you on for a while, and I'm glad we could finally make it happen.
Thank you. Hello, and thank you for having me.
Thanks for joining us. So, State Duma elections in Russia, even more than presidential elections, tend to be watershed moments in Putin's Russia. If you rewind a bit, back in 1999, well, that marked the end of the Yeltsin era, the Duma election in December 1999, and the true start of the Putin era. The 2003 election marked the turn to a more tightly controlled system of managed democracy. The 2007 election was a transition to the brief era of the tandem. And the 2011 election pointed to the breakdown of the old Putin system and led to the establishment of the current authoritarian one. If this pattern follows, the elections in September could prove to be some kind of a watershed. But will it be? Max, we got a tradition on the podcast. First time on, you get to talk first. So I'll go with you. What are you seeing out there? What kind of a watershed moment is this election shaping up to be?
We tend to downplay elections in Russia. People like myself, especially people from big cities, we don't think these are important because they don't change anything. But actually, they do, probably not immediately. So this is actually a very important event. And it apparently was meant to be important by the Kremlin. It's been a long time in preparation. They apparently have a plan for it. And the idea, I think, my guess, and from what I see, is that they are trying to pull off a kind of an impossible trick, make it both predictable and also kind of changing. They changed the system. We're going to have half of the new candidates, new deputies, would be elected on a non from the party lists, but from one seat districts. And they've allowed more parties to participate. But they, of course, never changed the attitudes. They still manipulate opinion and all that. So they kind of want to change something with these elections. What exactly, I don't know. I cannot really guess. But I think they are moving in the direction of, sounding ironic, I mean, actually in the direction of more democracy in the way Kremlin understands it.
So a return more back to the Surkovian system of managed pluralism is something along those lines? I mean, because it seems to me this party system is kind of reaching its past its sell-by date in a lot of ways. We've had these same parties in the Duma for the longest time, the same setup no matter what happens in the election. Do you see anything... What do you see changing if we're going to move towards more pluralism? And there are hints of that in the Russian media right now. You have to wonder what that's going to look like.
Well, mostly the way it's seen, the way I can see it now, mostly the change will come from these, one seat districts, mm-hmm. Candidates who are not predominantly who are not seen as party figures, but as as candidates, as political actors in their own right. So these people, they are presumably they will be less manageable. They will be more active on their own. So they presumably will bring some real, so let's say, elements of some real political demands from the voters who will elect them. So an element of real democracy will be there, of course, but of course it's not entirely what Western voters would expect from their election. It's a transition, the way I see it.
Sean, what do you see?
It's interesting. I mean, it is important that the fact that a lot of CAFT candidates aren't coming from party lists and they're coming from single districts, because what this, I think, allows to do is it allows for more pluralism, certainly, but I think more in terms of center-periphery relations, mm-hmm. and the sense that now by backing local candidates in various districts, local elites and local businesses can push forward their own agenda onto the center. So here you get some kind of representation of the periphery more than what you've had before, mm-hmm. which is party lists that don't really have any strong roots to the localities. So I think this is an important shift because it does allow for more regional elites to perhaps have more influence in Moscow, in the Duma at least. So in that sense, yeah, there is more pluralism. There is more, you know, quote unquote democracy, but of course within certain parameters. And I think
very
this
tight
is really,
parameters.
Well, yeah, very tight, but, you know, yeah, sure. But parameters still allow for some sort of movement. And as you've pointed out, elections in Russia are always – those parameters tend to expand to some extent – more than usual, and allows for more debate and more discussion and more conflict. I mean, particularly on the local level, I think you'll probably see far more conflict between local elites jostling and amongst one another. But you get more discussion in the press, you get more talk about what the agenda of the day is, of course, within certain parameters. And I think the Kremlin wants this. I think Max is right in the sense they want a more open but controlled system. Now, if we want to go back to an idea of managed democracy, I think that's worth thinking about because this was the agenda before 2008, right? I also think the issue of turnover is important, not just because of allowing single district seats to go for election to allow some sort of turnover within the politics of United Russia, but we also have to consider the fact that the opposition parties, particularly the LDPR and the Communist Party, their leadership needs to turn over [S2] Yeah. [S1] Sooner rather than later. And that's going to be a big question because I don't know much about the internal dynamics of the Communist Party. I think the LDPR is I don't know what will happen there, but will the turnover in the leadership in the CP also create an opposition party that's more oppositional?
Which I don't think, because the Kremlin doesn't want that. It wants their opposition parties to be housebroken.
Yes, that is true. But I think you also have to consider how does this work out on the local level. So it's not just opposition within the Duma, which I think will be quite tamed, but will there be more opposition, say, in local provincial Dumas?
Well, this is something Mark Galeotti's been arguing. He seems to think that the communists are going through this rebranding and that they might surprise a little bit in this election. If you look at their latest their campaign, it's got this hipster vibe. I mean, I don't know if you've seen some of these posters with Marx in a leather jacket and Lenin with a laptop and Stalin smoking an e-cigarette and things like that. So there is a bit that, but still at the end of the day, when this is all said and done, we're going to have Zhuganov, Zhirinovsky, you know, it's going to be the same people again. Max, something else I wanted to touch on is that this outgoing Duma has been something of a caricature in a lot of ways. I mean, like, you know, passing laws banning lace panties and ballet slippers and what have you. Is the Kremlin embarrassed by that and they're trying to get a Duma that's going to conduct itself a little bit better?
Well, I think they are. Well, the Kremlin is, of course, is not homogenous. There are different people there, but
many towers.
I think they do understand that this Duma was extreme, even by the Kremlin standards. And I think this is why there was this recently there was this hectic activity on the Duma floor with lots of legislation passing, including today's the so-called Yaravaya package,
right? The so-called anti-terrorism bill.
Yeah, passing today in somewhat edited way. So they've been trying to do whatever they apparently wanted before this Duma ends, because they understand that the next Duma will be different. And well, one other difference, I think, is that the difference of expectations from the regions, from the regional elites, regional governors. Previously, governors were responsible, well, quite cynically, basically. They were expected to produce the largest, you know, United Russia result, and that's it. The bigger, the better, essentially. So this time, apparently, the idea is for them to produce a more realistic breakdown of between these parties. I mean, of course, all the parties present in the current spectrum are not, I mean, they are real only to an extent.
Right.
They're all managed. They're all basically departments rather than real political parties. But with, I mean, said that, I mean, the idea apparently of the political managers in the Kremlin is to try and make sure that the regional elites sort of present these, so create a sort of a more pluralist, more diverse, I would say, breakdown of the legislature that would become, apparently, they think, a better reflection of the population's expectations, something like that.
Now, there's a huge irony in all that, because this is something Surikov was arguing for back in the time of the tandem. And there was this feeling that there was the system, and Sean and I, you and I talked about this a lot, how the system was kind of moving towards this managed pluralism. The events of 2011, 2012, and certainly the Ukraine crisis put an end to all that and created this hyper mobilization model based on war mobilization, essentially. So we're going back to Surikov, and basically, so Surikov wins and Volodin loses.
I tend to agree in a way. I mean, it would be something different, of course, but I think that the Kremlin is very, very slow. This is also something that we have to take into account. The year 2014, 2015 were extreme because of, obviously, because of the Crimea annexation and what followed, and the Ukrainian war and what followed, and sanctions. So the Kremlin went into emergency mode for these 2 years and, well, more than that already. So now I think the idea is to try and get out of the emergency mode and get to some kind of normalcy, the way they understand it. And yes, this includes some controlled pluralism, which they somehow believe that is, you know, more pluralism than controlled. I don't know. It's also, I mean, even for a Russian observer, it's hard to take these things seriously. But we kind of have to, because this is the political system we have.
Well, it's interesting you say that, Max, because Sean and I were having a conversation offline yesterday, and he said, I have to figure out how to pretend something is real that, in fact, isn't real. And that is the challenge of analyzing Russian elections, because they're anything but
exactly.
Elections. But yet they matter. They matter as I said in the intro, as a legitimation ritual.
Well,
go ahead,
yeah,
Sean.
I think that this is could be, from the Kremlin's perspective, perhaps some kind of heat check. In the sense of, they've had this, you know, they've had Crimea, and they had Ukraine, and they've been on a military, you know, patriotic mode. And this is certainly fading, and it's fading as the economy is worsening and worsening. And their mechanisms of understanding, in my view, their mechanisms of understanding the mood of the population are actually quite poor. because they pump a lot of propaganda and they don't get a real reality feedback. They can't trust what's going on in the localities very well.
Although they poll obsessively.
That's true. They poll obsessively, but the polls don't necessarily work as information gathering as it is a reaffirming practice. Mm. So if you put the elections, I think, in the context of all of these mechanisms, the wanting Putin put it, you know, more honest election is a way for the Kremlin to get a better sense of, okay, what's really going on out there and what are the expectations, I think, as Max said, is a perfect example.
So it's like let a thousand flowers bloom campaign.
Yeah, and this is a view of not being cynical about them, right? Or you could take the cynical view, which is the Duma is going to have to push through a lot of very unpopular legislation.
Yep.
In the fall and into the winter. And this is a way to get the vote out of the way, right? Because this is the elections have been moved from December to September. This is a way to get a mandate to politically explain all of these unpopular measures they're going to have to put through.
Now, these elections, the most important thing about these things is they're rituals. It's a ritual to legitimize the regime. And as the regime legitimizes itself in these elections, it tells a story. I mean, this is something it does in every election. They tell a story. One of the big mistakes they made in 2011 is they forgot to tell a story. And they paid the price for that. Navalny basically stole the story. We'll talk more about that in the second half. But what story are they going to tell this week, this time around? What's the story of this election that the Kremlin is going to tell the people? Max, what do you see there?
Well, that's a good way of putting it. Frankly, I don't understand it as of yet. And also, it might change because they're looking at things. I think that, today's biggest news, the British referendum, is also going to figure into this, I think, because the way the Kremlin, the political managers were reading the events recently, apparently, was that they were not particularly successful in getting out of the isolation, post-Crimea isolation. So the idea was to try and gradually move back to being a more of a partner the West and Europe, especially. So that's, I think, sort of the very, very general trend. Now that they see that Europe is sort of very manifestly in trouble, they would probably adjust something. But still, I think that the general trend will remain that Russia needs to be more of an economic partner, and also, I mean, the relative failure, let's put it like this, so almost a failure with China in trying to substitute the Western connection with the Chinese, with the pivot to China, it also sort of had a very sobering effect. So all this put together, I think, is pointing in the direction of more moderate politics on the Kremlin side and sort of trying to be more reasonable. But of course, within limits. And we see that President Putin continues his rhetoric. He doesn't stop, and he's just trying to balance the two things. And the idea, of course, is for Russia to get back to growth, to get back to producing things, to create opportunities for domestic growth and consumption, etc. So this is that's the general direction where they're trying to sort of to slightly change it, not radically.
Sean, what story do you see them telling here? And actually, Max brought up Brexit. We can't get through this podcast without talking about Brexit.
Yeah,
it had to come up at some point. It had to. But what story do you see them telling? And how does Brexit play into all this?
This is, I think, a real conundrum, because they have so few stories they can tell, and that is if the story is to actually get people to go out and vote. Right. The story is to get Russians to say, hey, these elections are really important. I'm going to participate in them, therefore providing the legitimacy that these elections perform.
Right. Turnout's more important than results.
Turnout is important. So what story can you tell to get people to come out and vote? Well, you can go to the Crimea option, but that's fading. Mm-hmm. You can't tell a story about the economy because there's not much story to tell that's positive, unless they come up with some sort of great grand plan, but I don't even know how far that's going to take. Making relations better with the West and with Europe.
That's a hard story to tell.
I don't see many people being moved by that.
No.
Right?
Thanks to what they've done. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, if you're out in, you know, Yaroslavl or something, or even farther out, I mean, what is this going to matter to you? Like, okay, fine. I don't really travel to Europe anyways because I don't have the money. So, so I wonder what story they're going to tell. And this might unfold in the next month or so. But I do agree they need to tell some story, precisely because there was a poll that came out yesterday that pretty much said I think only a third of Russians actually know that when the elections are, and so there's not a lot of and the elections are in September.
When people are still going to be in the dachas.
Exactly, which is a vacation time. So they're going to have to somehow do something to get people moving, and I don't really know what that thing is.
Yeah, no, and it seems to me they are. You're right, Sean. They're in a conundrum because, I mean, again, this is happening at a time not just of an economic crisis. United Russia's ratings are falling precipitously right now. And it's this same old menu. And how do you get people excited about it? It's like a TV show that's been on for too many years and you're tired of it.
Yeah, and you can't use populism, right? You can't even use the cleavage within United Russia proper and then the all-Russian front people that are part of it that are kind of a weird – I don't know what role they're going to play. But you can't even – the front can't even use the populism because the government doesn't have any money to do the populism. And everybody knows that because Medvedev said it.
Medvedev let it slip, right. Max, right. What about that? Is Sean right? They're in a bit of a bind here. And what about the role of Narodny Front, of the Popular Front in this election? Because if I've looked at the projected future Dumas, and they're going to have a lot of seats, probably almost as many as United Russia. Is there a conundrum here?
Russia reached a limit of how it could expand militarily and sort of socially, the kind of the state expansion that continued after 2012, after Putin's return to power, because it all basically bumped into economic limits. The Kremlin continues to be macroeconomically conservative, which means they don't want to continue expansion by hugely over-leveraging, overreaching. They want to stay conservative. That's why they need growth. And to get growth, to get the economic growth back, they need to try and do something for the economy. So this is the kind of the big picture. They cannot expand their military spending right now, which is ironic because the 2 years after Crimea finally persuaded everyone in the world, especially in Europe, that they also need to try and expand and increase their military spending. And now Russia cannot do it anymore, basically, because even if Russia spends more, the manufacturing capacity in Russia has reached its limit. Russia simply cannot process even the kind of spending it has now. So it's less than 4% of GDP, but it's you know, even this is...
Which dwarfs Europe, by the way. But
yeah, yeah. So anyway, so this is one thing. And I think this is actually the most important. And also the relationship, Moscow relationship with its own regions, because it's clear that the existing parties are not going to become more popular. And the Kremlin's response is the All Russia Popular Front, which is, began as a simulation, but by now is kind of almost a real institution. Of course, it's a highly controlled, highly managed institution whose idea and mission is to be a sort of pro-Kremlin Navalny, somebody who's a watchdog, somebody whose mission is to try and watch the governors and the oligarchs and the big players and control for corruption and see what happens and try to make them accountable. So this is the Kremlin's thinking is very democratic in a way. It's just that they really believe that they can manage it all, that they can create phenomena rather than let them grow. So this hasn't changed. They still believe it. Apparently, they want to allow for more life to be in the institutions they create.
Mm. You said it started out as a simulation and became a real institution. What do you mean by that? 'Cause that's interesting.
Well, it's kind of, I think, I mean, my feeling is that it's kind of taking some life, the All Russia Front. They are trying. That's what I hear from people who believe in it. I mean, I myself is skeptical. I don't think this is the way you develop. But, I mean, we are trying to analyze what's there. So the Kremlin seriously believes that they can create an environment which would produce results similar to a normal democracy, despite it being a managed democracy. And I think Putin's experience as in East Germany in the 80s is very important, because this is the
East German system. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. This is the East German system
where you had multiple parties, but all of them were tightly controlled. Sean, did you want to jump in?
I think the other issue too is that there, and this has been the question I've been seeing in the Russian press to some extent, is okay, Putin's, if you go by the opinion polls, Putin has very high approval ratings. Medvedev's government doesn't, and neither does United Russia. They're not horrible. They're in the 50% mark for Medvedev's government and United Russia, but that's not good by Russian polling standards. So the big question too is that how far can Putin take his legitimacy and keep it uncoupled from the government? At what point when people will see the government and start connecting it to Putin? And therefore, I think part of the reason why they want to get these Duma elections out of the way is they can put this process behind them and then start moving to deal with 2018.
And it's good that you brought up 2018, because there's a lot of speculation about 2018 going into these elections. There was a really interesting interview with Nikolai Petrov in Nezavisima Gazeta, where he fleshed out a lot of different scenarios. And one of them, he said maybe there'll be early presidential elections to get that out of the way, too. But then he also said Putin might step down. What did you make of that?
You know, I don't know what to make of this stuff, because on the one hand, it would be a very smart move. And Petrov pointed to the fact of, well, then Putin can be this kind of national father figure.
And again, we're back to 2008.
We're back to 2008, where he can basically still enjoy a lot of prestige and a lot of power if he cuts the right deal with the elite. And he can continue, you know, having a major influence over Russian politics and, you know, as he said a few weeks ago, defend Russia to the end of his life. it would be a very smart move because there is a question of the turnover question is a really important question because the system has no dynamism right now.
And the system has no mechanism for turnover.
And it has no mechanism. They haven't come up with a mechanism of creating that turnover. So if Putin does, I think if that's the choice quite wisely, sets a precedent for that, then that might increase energy within the system because a lot of people will say, oh, okay, Putin's gone. We can – this opens up the space for a lot of different possibilities, right?
We both thought that would have been a wise thing to do back in 2011.
Exactly.
And so, did a lot of people in Russia. So did Surikov. And Pavlovsky.
So I think a lot of it will depend on the international situation too as well, whether if this question of Putin stepping aside or not – you know, how things are in relations with the West, I think will determine a lot of that as well.
Right, because Petrov makes the argument that he's in basically a legitimation crisis, right?
Or legitimacy.
He really has – they're at the ends of their legitimacy. Max, what did you make of the arguments Nikolai Petrov made in Nezavisma Gazeta? Because I thought there was a lot of intriguing stuff there. Either early elections get Putin reelected early or maybe Putin doesn't stand at all. What did you make of that?
Well, yeah, I totally agree with Nikolai on this, what he says, that this election is meant to be about still manipulation, but not about outright falsification. They want this election to be, well, let's say, almost real, in the sense that, yes, the Kremlin controls access to the elections. There are political forces that will not be able to take part, but those who will expected to compete in a real way. It does sound kind of like a paradox, but that apparently is the expectation. The Kremlin wants the game to be real. But of course, the participants, the players in the game, will all be cleared.
Right, and so, controlled to a degree.
Yeah. So this is one, and I do agree with this. But as for the early, for the snap election, for early election, it's been the idea has been around for quite a while. And actually, first I heard it from people close to Alexei Kudrin. More than a year ago,
yeah,
actually.
Yeah, that's right.
The idea was, well, because even at that time, the Kudrin people, German Griev, and Igor Shuvalov, the deputy prime minister, they were saying that the economy needs a serious revamp and an administrative reform is needed, and they were citing the Kazakhstan example.
Exactly.
And the idea was to try and call a snap election, get fresh legitimacy into the system, and for Putin to announce some kind of sweeping or not so sweeping, administrative reform and, some structural change. So this was the idea originally, the way I remember it. It might be something different now, who knows, but quite frankly, I don't really buy it right now. I don't see how and who would be the, I mean, personalities that important. The only one is Dmitry Medvedev right now. There were some rumors about the new Tver governor, Dumin,
right,
who was kind of, I mean, the Kremlin introduced and installed him as a governor with a kind of aura of significance, and maybe he is one of the, important, meant to be important players in the future, but I mean, still, he is quite unknown, so I don't know who might play that role if Putin decides to step down soon, I don't think.
I just, not there yet. Color me skeptical on this. I mean, the same reasons for Putin stepping down exist today that existed in 2011. And he didn't do it in 2011 for a whole host of reasons, mostly because his inner circle, key people in his inner circle, didn't want him to step down because they would have lost control over the process and over key assets. Those conditions still exist.
Yes.
And so I'm very skeptical about Putin stepping aside.
And I think I think that there were more reasons for Putin to let Medvedev run for the second time. There were more reasons in 2011 than now.
Yeah.
And also, I mean, if I may, I mean, it was apparently, again, we are not 100% proof, but it seems that at the time there was a real political split within the elites, and there was some who were really supporting Medvedev's second term, and apparently that was behind the conflict somewhere there within the Kremlin system. I don't see any conflict now. What we know doesn't suggest that. I mean, today they are more united around the idea of the system, the way it works now. The elites are very tightly sort of gathered around the Kremlin right now. So I don't really see a conflict there. There might be something brewing in the regions and among the elites, regional elites, far outside of Moscow. That might be the case, but not in the center.
And also, at this time, they seem to be losing their skill at managing the process. I mean, look at the United Russia primaries and how those things played out. I mean, that was a disaster. And you had falsification inside the primaries and allegations within the ruling party of falsification. Sean,
there was also another article that I read last night in Nizhnyaya Gazeta about, the Kremlin wants their operatives in the provinces to carry out this election as clean as possible, or how did Petrov put it? You know, predictable, but no falsification. But do the regional elites know how to do that?
I don't think so. I don't think so.
Exactly. Think
so.
Yeah.
Right. They've been running under the. I mean, Max pointed this out quite early in our discussion that they run under the ritual of producing high turnout, high numbers.
Right.
And if they have to use whatever administrative resources to do that, and they do it. Now the problem this time, of course, is will the administrative resources be there? Because there's no money for doing any wild, you know, manipulation. So how do they square this paradox of predictable yet no falsifications? And do they even have the skill to do it out there? And that's, I think, the big question. The Kremlin may sincerely want the cleanest election that is possible within the parameters that they've established.
By their definition of clean.
Yeah, always. But can the provincial political elite actually produce that? Do they have the skill to do it? And this, I think, is one of the interesting aspects of these single district candidates, because to some extent, they actually have to campaign. They actually have to be charismatic to some certain extent to woo the local population. And that will be interesting how this plays out. I mean, it is a transitional – I think this election is transitional – or potentially transitional to a large extent.
Yeah, no, I think it is, and I think the Kremlin does not have as firm a grip on the process as we would think. In a few moments, we will continue our discussion on Russia's political season and look at how the non-systemic opposition will be approaching this critical political season. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFURL. Joining me on the Skype line from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, is Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies and host of the SRB podcast. Also joining us via Skype from Berlin is Maxim Trudolubov, a senior fellow at the Kennan Institute in Washington and editor-at-large of the Russian business daily Vedomosti. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfrl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Я хочу участвовать в выборах государственных.
Меня не пускают на них.
Партия прогресса хочет участвовать.
Партия прогресса преодолела бы.
Я участвовал в мэрских выборах, я участвовал
в региональных кампаниях.
Мне официально запрещено участвовать в выборах. Партия прогресса, которая...
Five years ago, Алексей Навальный stole the show. In the run-up to the December 2011 elections, the anti-corruption blogger branded United Russia the party of swindlers and thieves and successfully persuaded large numbers of voters not to boycott the elections, but to vote for anybody but the ruling party. As a result, the Kremlin was caught with its pants down and forced to resort to the crudest and most transparent methods of falsification, and then faced the largest street protests Russia had seen since the collapse of the Soviet Union. This time around, Navalny has been marginalized. This week he wrote a letter to Putin asking for his Party of Progress to be allowed to run. Opposition journalist Oleg Kashin lampooned this in Sloan.ru, writing, "You are a tyrant, a thief, and a killer. Now please allow me to participate in your election." Beyond this, we have splits in Parnas, the party of People's Freedom, despite talk of a potential electoral alliance with Yabloko. Will the non-systemic opposition be a factor this time at all? Max, what do you think?
Well, to a very, very limited extent. They will campaign from outside. They will remain outsiders during this election, it seems. Well, for the exception of a very select group of people who might run. I mean, we know that, for example, Dmitry Gudkov is running. And, I mean, he technically is not even a non-systemic opposition. He is an MP, and he will run. So, but he is because he's very close with many opposition figures. He is sort of the kind of representative of non-systemic views within the system. I know that the number of people running who are running with the help of Mikhail Khodorkovsky's Open Russia election program, and there are people like Andrei Zubov, the historian,
yes,
who I know personally, and he decided to run, which is kind of I think a little controversial, but anyway, he is trying. He wants to try, which is good. So there would be some select separate cases of apparently very interesting, completely non-systemic campaigns. And they will attract attention simply because they are, you know, they stand out. So these will produce something. If anybody of these, I mean, anyone from these people will get elected, I don't know. Dmitry Gudkov has a chance, actually, because the guy who's the candidate who's standing against him is Gennady Anishenko, the former, how they are called these people, the sanitary chief hygienist. He was this doctor responsible for sanitary rules in Russia, and he is a very famous figure, actually.
Responsible for all the bans of wine from Georgia
and
agricultural products from Ukraine,
so
and so on.
He's of course, is a strong candidate. But, but this will produce some interesting, definitely some interesting social media posts and talk and discussions and some buzz. So these things will create a lot of buzz. They probably won't become politically significant in any systemic sense, but they will be there. I'm sure.
What about Parnas?
Well, it's kind of a sad story. It is the way I understand it now. They will run, yes, and they have. I think they do have some chances. I think that a few, I mean, probably two or three, I don't know, a very, very, very few may even get elected. But again, that's the same. That's the same story. I think that, well, as long as the political system remains divided the way it is in Russia, it's kind of the non-systemic part is not getting stronger, is not getting stronger. Yeah. And the systemic part actually does seem to get a little more life in it. So we are witnessing probably a moment when it will, well, the non-systemic part will kind of remain more of a media phenomenon. Mm. And the systemic part will continue to sort of to play the role of Russia's domestic politics. Right. Yeah, but just to conclude, I think that the actual political political divisions, the actual political strife, it does not go along the party lines in Russia, and it's between the continued mobilization and militarization and peaceful development. I mean, to put it bluntly, right? And so this is the kind of real division, and there are supporters of a peaceful, probably difficult development on the one hand, and there are supporters of this kind of extraordinary projects, militarization, more provocation kind of way of doing politics on the other hand. So we have, this is sort of the broad division that we have, and there are supporters of the peaceful path within this system, within the political
and all
field.
Of the non-system.
Yeah, well, and all of the non-system. Yeah, so this we might with time, if we are allowed to dream, we might with time see the kind of convergence of this pro-development systemic part of the political spectrum with the non-systemic one.
No,
but probably not during the upcoming elections.
No, I used to call that when Alexei meets Alexei, when Navalny meets Kudrin, basically. But yeah. Sean, what are your thoughts on the non-systemic and on Navalny?
It kind of reminds me of the small leftist parties in the United States that when there are elections, they run, and their elections are mostly educative because they're completely outside the system. They can barely get on ballots if they actually can get on the ballots. And they run a campaign because this is a way to promote their ideas. This is a way to get in an audience. And I think at this time around, I think the media buzz is pretty much the extent in which they could hope for. And also, I think, because of the restrictions on them, and also, you know, their message doesn't really fully communicate to a lot of voters at this point. The other thing is just experience and training, like training these people how to engage in campaigns, how to run a campaign, and build on that experience of the past and develop new people who are running in these campaigns. So I think that's important, too, and to this extent. But I think beyond that, I don't, of course, see much of an impact. Now, the question of the specter of 2011, I think that a lot of that depends on how the election unfolds by the Kremlin and their regional actors. You know, how much falsification are they going to do, and how blatant will it be?
Yeah.
I think that's going to may be a big issue. So a lot of it is in the hands of the central hands of the authorities. For this. And I think all of the measures that they're erecting, the anti-terrorism bills, the restrictions over the internet and social media, the National Guard, they're preparing
for the worst.
They're preparing for the worst, but they're I think what's important, more important, is that they're sending a signal for the it's expanding the concept of extremism.
Right.
Right. To lock in and to smash, if need be, those people they consider at a particular point, if things get chaotic, as quote-unquote extremists.
Right. No, so yeah, it's an exercise in intimidation is what it is, to prevent the specter of 2011.
Yes, absolutely.
Which mm-hmm. brings me back to Navalny. I mean, has Navalny been effectively neutralized? Is he finished? Because it's, I mean, seeing him beg to be allowed to run was really jarring, actually.
Well, I don't think he is finished. I kind of believe in him. He is very agile and the kind of personality who's not easily silenced or, you know, gives up. I don't think he's a very serious person, I think. And also he's young.
Yeah.
Which is good. And I think that he will continue to be a media phenomenon for the time being. But, that's important. And I don't right now understand how the non-systemic and systemic parts of the spectrum will converge. I don't see it in practical terms so far, but I do believe that Navalny will continue to be a player. He still has social capital. He still has ability and an organization that he built. So he has ways of making things happen.
And you got to remember, this is a man that almost forced the second round in the Moscow mayor's election. This is a guy that used to be able to put thousands of people on the streets at any time.
But this also had a lot to do with the conditions.
Yeah.
Right? It was coming after a wave of a lot of public political mobilization, or at least opposition mobilization. I think that for him, for Navalny's impact, I think a lot of it will have to do with the political conditions at the time. And is there a space for him to take the capital that he has and turn it into something bigger, because people are energized and mobilized and receptive, more receptive to it than under normal circumstances? The thing is that the opposition has been completely deflated.
Yeah.
And they haven't figured out, or they haven't been presented with the opportunity to hook on something to re-energize themselves and to coalesce around.
Well, if you bring this whole discussion back full circle and go to what we were talking about in the very beginning, and both Sean, you and Max were saying it seems that the Kremlin wants to dial things back to kind of a pre-2011 managed democracy, tightly managed democracy type of model. Well, that was precisely the model that Navalny thrived in. That was the model that made Navalny. That's the model in which he made his name as an anti-corruption blogger, and that's a model in which he burst into the political scene. So is the Kremlin creating the conditions for Navalny to be a factor again, as I guess how I'd like to wrap it up? Max, why don't you jump in?
As I say, I mean, he will continue to be a media, a very important media phenomenon and an actor, and actually, I mean, a political actor who's outside the system. I think that in Russia's culturally sort of by the reasons of history and culture, Russia is kind of more tolerant to this kind of outsider politics. And it's kind of more real, I think, than in many places where you have these forces who are outsiders, non-systemic, that are completely marginalized. I don't think that even today, which is, well, arguably a very low point for the non-systemic forces, I mean, they still are real and I think more real than in established democracies. So they just have to come up with ways of being, you know, more visible, being present, being there. They will not be affecting the political result in the narrow sense, the result of the elections, but they will affect people's thinking. I believe in this. I think that they will. And this will continue affecting politics in the future.
Sean, your last word to you. I mean, is if they are going back to this pre 2011 model of managed pluralism, if you will, is that creating the conditions for Navalny to thrive again?
I'm not so sure that period actually created the conditions as much as the state of emergency created the conditions, right? I think if the Navalny certainly had a trajectory of influence before the mass protests in 2011.
That's what I mean. He made his name during the Medvedev period, basically.
Yeah, he did, because, I mean, it was a much more open period in general, kind of looking back at it retrospectively. But he really shot up to even more influence in the state of emergency after the protests in 2011. And that state of emergency has mostly continued up until the present. If you put in all of the events from the protests through Ukraine and Crimea and the Donbass and everything, and now that state of emergency looks like it's
permanent.
it's permanent. It's permanent. They want to maintain the structure of permanence, but the atmosphere of normalcy.
Right.
So this is. So if you couple all of the repressive measures that have been only increasing with the desire to go back to some sort of normal political life, how they do this is a good question. But will, if they go back to that, say, if we say, okay, pre-2011 scenario, will Navalny thrive in that? I don't know, because I think the crisis is what actually propelled a lot of opposition forces to a level that they'd never experienced before.
Right.
Now I should say, though, that Max is absolutely right, and I agree with him, that Navalny is a big player regardless of his being marginalized. Because in many ways, he is setting a lot of political agendas through his anti-corruption work. I mean, look at what the Chaika thing did. It completely captured the rhetoric, at least amongst in the media, in the serious media, right? The Panama Papers only came on top of that and also changed the dynamics. So I think in that sense, he still has a lot of influence in the general political discourse to some extent. And I think that will continue. In perhaps a state of, you know, pre-2011 will even have more space for that. Who knows?
Well, one thing we could be sure of, it's going to be a hot summer and a hotter autumn. And on that note, we will wrap it up for this week. I'd like to remind you, you've been listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me on the Skype line from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, has been Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh Center for Russian Eastern European Studies and host of the SRB podcast. Also joining us via Skype from Berlin has been Maxim Trudolubov, a senior fellow at the Kennan Institute in Washington and editor-at-large of the Russian business daily Vedomosti. Thank you, gentlemen, for an enlightening discussion.
Thank you.
And I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Kancheva, and my indispensable and totally awesome colleague, Pavel Butorin, managing editor of RFRL's Russian language television program, Current Time, which you can watch at www.currenttime.tv. You can also follow Pavel on the Twitter at Pasha Butorin. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfrl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.